So I think the format this morning is we're going to start out with just a free-for-all discussion about what kind of, about problems in population genetics and genomics that people are interested in or people think we ought to pay attention to, ought to be given particular attention at this meeting, are potentially solvable or beyond solutions, whatever, I don't know. Then maybe we'll take a 10 or 15 minute break after that. And then Dick is going to start with a tutorial in population genetics, and I suppose mostly about coalescent processes. And he's starting off on the right foot. No slides, no. He's going to teach us. So that's great. So I don't know, I don't really want to lead this. Perhaps there's someone else who's willing to just stand up and moderate this.
I think you're already standing up.
Okay.
I can start by throwing out the random
epistasis.
I sort of need to be educated on how one actually goes about detecting selection.
Detecting
selection. No, so we're happy to assume neutrality. To what extent it's a bad assumption? Maybe.
Well, I think that's a good point. I have noticed to the limited extent that I actually read sort of the physics literature or the kind of physicist mathematicians who kind of delve into a little bit of population genetics. It's generally neutral theory, and it'd be very nice if that community, you know, shifted more into understanding selection. Now, detecting selection is one particular aspect of that problem.
Yeah. So, do you want to subdivide that?
Since I've been volunteered to give this Monday lunch talk next week, I think it's going to be largely devoted to talking about that, because my own history is one of thinking about inferred patterns of selection from evolutionary data. And in the last day, started to think about what I would talk about.
That's the question that underlies what population geneticists do. Although they may be analyzing neutral models, it's because they want to get to that question, I think, detecting it and characterizing selection in lots of ways. I mean, another kind of question that maybe in population genetics we don't typically phrase it this way, but I think is kind of a good one, is between species, how much of the genetic divergence at the sequence level reflects adaptation? And it's not a question about how do you detect it, but it's kind of what we want to get to, one aspect of sort of within and between species issues about selection.
This is like adaptive divergence.
Right, yeah.
Substitutions. Yeah, and there's been a very interesting kind of history about this. Because I'll talk about, focus on patterns of variation and evolution and single gene loss. I really started with my advisor, Dick Lewontin, when he discovered you could look at allozymes on gels, these native conformations of proteins sieved through gels, and find charge variants and sometimes shape variants, but identify specific allelic variants of individual gene loci. And him being a student of Dobzhansky, I think there was more or less perhaps a somewhat naive pan-selectionist view of that variation. And those views were quickly squashed with the development of the neutral theory. And particularly people like Masatoshi Ne and others who hammered away, pointing out that every single pattern and feature of allozyme polymorphism, as it could be described, the frequency spectrum distribution, the number of alleles, it all seemed to fit quite nicely with the neutral model. Of course, other people, Dick's advisor, John Gillespie, who would have been nice to get here, pointed out that those are probably also compatible with selection models as well. But really, the neutralists just hammered home the fact that all of this is compatible with neutral evolution. And you know, when I first started out looking at sequence polymorphism, it was extremely dangerous to go to an evolutionary meeting and suggest that something in that DNA pattern looked like selection. Because we were filled with disciples of these neutralist camps, and the field was quite polarized. But it was a dangerous occupation. There has really been a sea change in the last maybe 5 or less than 10 years back towards selection and appreciation that there's perhaps an immense amount of the variation is, or a large proportion is explainable by selection. And I think some of that's hopefully going to come out in the meeting. I know I'm going to talk about it. Perhaps Dick is going to talk about it. And it's going to come up again and again. Actually, Peter Andolfato is going to be here. And he's really been, in my mind, perhaps the most insightful person analyzing sequence variation data, looking for selection. So there's going to be lots of opportunities to explore these issues. That said, perhaps Bob's going to talk next week about modeling selection with coalescent processes, if we're lucky. And that's an extremely hard problem, and it's still in its infancy. So there's one thing about rejecting neutrality, and there's another thing about actually modeling selection and knowing what specific predictions are.
But, you know, it's not a matter of rejecting it. Most things can be neutral, but somehow to give some room for Darwin to operate, something has to be selected, right? And then the question is, how good an approximation is neutrality, and how one develops a better approximation to include some selection, or maybe it's not even a good starting point, but one somehow has to start by asking a question: how good an approximation it is, right?
Well, all I can say is that people like Peter Andolfato and quite a number of other people, Jonathan Pritchard is engaged in some, is doing genome-wide surveys, applying some kind of statistical tests that look for patterns that are inconsistent with neutrality. And my colleague Chung-Yi Wu has done that genome-wide. And these people come up with like encoding regions or something like that, that perhaps 50% or 30% or 70% or 60% is selected. And I guess, it's very hard for me to actually swallow. On the other hand, it was one of my own former students, Hiroshi Akashi, who really opened my eyes more than my own work, which a long time ago I did with Dick on an ADH polymorphism when we thought we saw a signature of selection. I'm working on codon bias. And up until that point, we always thought of even in Drosophila, as these synonymous changes as some proxy, rough proxy for neutrality. There's still arguments about that, because Peter Andolfato still thinks that it is a pretty good proxy. But we also know that there is selection for codon bias or biased codon usage in Drosophila, not in mammals. But it seems like if species have a large enough population size, then this kind of the weak selection that operates on codon bias becomes
so dominant. And you can have population size in Drosophila.
Well, we're going to get into this, and I'm sure Dick's going to talk about this a lot, but perhaps the effective population that explain the variation maybe on the order of 10 to the 7th, something like that. So, and actually when you kind of model this weak selection to explain the patterns of codon bias variation, the strength of selection is something on the reciprocal of that. So we're talking about perhaps selection on the order of 1 part per million, like in a million generations, if you have that allele, you leave one more offspring. exceedingly weak selection, yet it produces fairly, in some genes, highly expressed genes, dramatically biased patterns of coding usage. And Hiroshi applied these ideas that we had developed about inferring selection, looking at polymorphism and divergence and doing these tests. And he showed very clearly that you can reject these neutral models for the patterns of polymorphism and divergence. And applying some population genetics estimates strength selection. The strength selection has to be extremely weak on codon bias because synonymous changes are highly polymorphic. And once selection gets to be like 10 times the reciprocal of population size, 20 times, there's very little polymorphism left. So in order for there to be a lot of polymorphism and a high rate of evolution, you kind of have to be in this very narrow zone. And so not surprisingly, you estimate these selection coefficients that put it right in this very weak selection boundary. Well, but the statistical tests really showed it quite convincingly. And so, okay, selection can see these, you know, synonymous changes, so perhaps amino acid polymorphisms are kind of dead meat for selection. You know, they're all selected. I don't know. I'm very confused about the whole situation.
And the cause of selection is what? Is DNA like in bacteria or what?
Say again, no.
The cause, the mechanism for selection of codon bias is the same as in bacteria?
Yes, absolutely the same as far as anyone can tell. Yeah, that it matches tRNA. It's involved in translational efficiency and accuracy, something like that. But the codon bias really opened my eyes. You know, selection can reach way down to pick up very subtle changes and act on them. These people who are estimating a very high, you know, percentage of sites that are under selection, perhaps it's right, but it still doesn't sit very well with me. I've kind of been brought up also with neutral theory, trying to explain otherwise how there can be so much polymorphism segregated. So,
but the fact that you don't swallow 30, 40, 50% is historical, or you think there's, you know, it's just that you grew up with neutral theory, or?
No, I think if you went back to the Fisherians, you know, in the 20s or 30s, they would be very comfortable with that.
It might be.
But there was this tremendous sea change towards neutrality to the point where it was, as they say, heretical to even suggest that there was, you could find a site under selection, and now this sea change back. And perhaps in part it is because there's a new generation of people that have come into the field that don't carry all this historical baggage. And
isn't it also the amount of data that is around now that you can actually detect more precisely selection?
No question about it. But I think we're gonna learn a lot about this. This
point. I'd like to make a comment. So the field I'm working in is virology, and there's no doubt that selection is going on there. We have drugs against viruses. When you apply that to people, certain mutations that we beforehand expect to come up, and the virus is resistant. There's no doubt about it that there's selection there. And similarly, we can map human immune system responses, depending on which HLA the person has, there are certain mutations that we expect, and sure enough, they come up after a while if the virus is transmitted from one individual to another. So to me, it seems bizarre not to believe that we can detect selection.
And
even pretty simple methods can find these positions that I'm talking about.
I was going to make a general point about modeling selection, which is that there's many kinds of selection, but there's only one kind of neutrality. So if you're going to have a model with selection, then you have to define your model very carefully, and you have to know there's not just one way of defining a model. That's another reason why it's difficult to detect selection from things like distributions of allele frequencies and heterozygosities and things, because it's sensitive on not just the fact that the selection is there, but on how the selection works. Right?
Well, but on top of that, I think this is one of the serious problems in making good inferences, is that there's also maybe one kind of neutrality, but many, many kinds of demography. Just for almost any pattern of polymorphism, one can embed kind of history of population expansions and contractions and such, or migration, that also can fit the data. So
is that genome-wide data or locus?
Well, no doubt, right? That's what I think one of the great hopes is that you know, these population history effects may have a much broader effect across the genome than selection acting on an individual variant of locus, and that one may be able to tease the two apart. But that gets into this problem that I'm sure is going to come up here as well, and so it was just the subject of last week's Nature. You know, what do you do with petabytes of data? How do you analyze the immense amounts of polymorphism data? And it's not trivial, because if you want to look at all of it, then much of it is linked to other sites. And so take into account all the linkage effects.
So I think that's a big question, how to analyze massive data sets when you've got sort of a tree signal back in time. And so you'd like to know something about ancestry from rather massive data sets where there's lots of recombination and possibly selection and a whole lot of things going on. Yet certainly there's an ancestral signal. That's very strong. In fact, you'd think it'd be easier with lots and lots of data, but I don't think it is. Because with small data sets, you can sort of see what's happening with the ancestry. But with large ones, it's not so clear. So I think it needs statistical techniques to understand what's going on back in time.
On the subject of colon usage, something I'm interested in at the moment is trying to distinguish between selection for speed and selection for accuracy. So we did a lot of work assuming that it was speed, and we were looking at bacterial species and looking at how the selection for speed would be related to the tRNA genes in the bacterial species. And I'd be getting into arguments with people who say, well, it's not to do with speed, it's to do with accuracy. And that sometimes accuracy and speed go in the same direction. So what I'm kind of interested in at the moment is trying to think of ways of distinguishing which of those is most important.
Which is most important, but
sometimes inaccuracy is important too.
That's right.
If you're completely accurate, you get no mutations.
Translational accuracy.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Well, what Hiroshi did, because he published a paper on that, as you know.
I know he did the conserved variable science.
Right, the pictures are.
Yeah.
It was enough to indicate that there was some signal there for accuracy, but I don't know, not a quantitative estimate of that.
Relative the magnitude strength of the speed and the
relative accuracy. Speeds.
Yeah.
So if we're ready for another question, how is genotypic variation related to phenotypic variation?
People work on that.
I think it's something for the future.
Well, anyone that's interested in disease, genetic disease, is trying to make that connection, right? Yeah.
Genotesting, isn't that the role of molecular genetics, system biology?
Well,
I imagine this in having some particular population genetic aspect in addition.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you can think about it, if you've got a phenotype that you're interested in, you can ask what genetic variants might be associated with that. But I suppose what I was thinking about was approaching it from the other side. You find some variation in the genome, and you want to know, what does this do? Mm-hmm.
There's an association study through that.
Yeah.
Well, you're thinking about starting from a particular locus where there's some variation, and then trying to figure out what it might.
So it could be a particular locus that for some reason you're interested in, you see some variation there, you want to know what effect that has, or it could be a more genome-wide analysis. You see these variants in the genome. What do they do?
They're quite different problems. I don't know which one is the inverse problem. Maybe they're both. Just blindly taking the whole genome and seeing if there's something that correlates with a phenotype, as opposed to being interested in a particular locus and understanding the variation.
Or I think one practical way that we might come across this is if we screen the genome for a signal of selection and we see what we think is an interesting signal, then we'd like to know what is that doing, what has been selected there. We have no prior information about that, so is there any way other than being very lucky or making guesses that we can get at that?
Can I throw in the radical interjection? And I think that anything that has a phenotype selected?
Wherever there's phenotypic variation, there's...
But, I can imagine there will be some condition under which it will be selected for or against. But, so truly neutral things should have no phenotypes. And then, of course, the question is, phenotypes, one may need some special conditions to observe a phenotype in the first place.
Just
a question.
Inside of the cells count as phenotypes. I mean, you can make a mutation in a protein or something which affects what's going on biochemically, and you wouldn't necessarily see anything. But that would you call that a phenotype, nevertheless? Because it would be important to the organism, that's the point.
And in a way, and just getting back to your point, there's only one way of being neutral, i.e. have no effect. At least synonymous, right? But there are very many ways of having a phenotype and being selected.
But the neutralists admit to there being lots of selection of the form that it fixes the most adaptive variants. And the only things that do reach any kind of appreciable frequencies as polymorphisms are the ones that truly don't have any effect and are neutral. So,
yeah, but having an effect, I think that, to me, that's the sort of problem with this. Having an effect, do you mean having an effect on probably survival and reproductive characteristics, or do you mean having an effect you can measure in a laboratory with a meter or something?
So ultimately, you're talking about reproduction and survival.
Exactly. And so I thought your question was sort of if you can measure it, beyond a sequence difference.
Yeah.
That you're suggesting as a hypothesis that it always has a selective effect in terms of fitness, ultimately. I mean, was that your suggestion?
It's following the same, it's basically the same logic as I was using about the codon bias. I mean, in Drosophila, selection can reach down and pick up one silly little third position change, then certainly a phenotype you can actually see and measure on the fly. Has to be large, immensely larger than.
But still, one does have a lot of phenotypic and genotypic variation, which wouldn't be expected if you just quench all your variation by strong selection.
Yeah, there's an interesting problem that I've gotten into because my wife works on disease resistance in Arabidopsis. But in plants and animals, there's an immense amount of polymorphism for disease resistance, and that's also, that's a trait where you ought to think that there's large selection operating, strong selection, and yet there's a ton of polymorphism. You might think it'd be good to be fixed for the most resistant genotype. It's invariably not the case. Species in general segregate for a tremendous amount of polymorphism.
So actually, that's...
So it must be conditional in some way.
So that goes back to... I guess in a way what I was trying to imagine I was trying to make a distinction between fluctuating selection and neutrality. So imagine that something is selected but that is either background dependent or environment dependent. So much so that so then the question is how does one distinguish neutrality from some sort of intermittent background-dependent, environment-dependent phenotypes, which ultimately do not easily lead to fixation. So I'm basically trying to make a distinction between selection and fixation. But you can imagine that things that have some sort of complex phenotypes and are environment-dependent, right, I'm not neutral, but I'm not fixated on it.
Well, I don't know. There was a period where kind of models of like temporally fluctuating selection were investigated, and it was kind of my impression that the results were that there's some relatively strong restrictions on the conditions under which those kind of spatial and temporal selection can actually maintain polymorphism over the long term. And so to some extent, I think it tends to move the field, move away from thinking about those. And yet, on the other hand, like with disease resistance in plants, it's just absolutely clear there has to be a huge spatiotemporal component that's all of it, to maintain that polymorphism. And so I agree with you, but the field has been ignored a little bit. I should say, in 2 weeks, we're getting a trio of Nagalaki, Liu, and Berger, who are one of the few real theoreticians who have spent their careers, especially Tom Nagalaki, modeling selection. In particular, in geographically subdivided populations, and especially along clines. And as I was telling you, like from the Alizine era, where the neutralists were continuously showing that everything fit the neutral pattern, the one thing that they really couldn't explain too easily were clines in allele frequencies. You see a geographic cline north to south in a particular Alizine, but not at other ones. And perhaps it was those kind of observations that kind of spurred people like Tom to start thinking about those kind of models. But I think actually we're in for a really wonderful week of discussions about modeling selection geographical models.
But I think part of the falling out of favor of the temporal varying selection was just the difficulty of analyzing. So a lot of people just avoided it because it was a hard problem. And there were a few, I think, missteps at certain phases of the history of it too that kind of suggested what you're saying, that there was really this narrow range and things had to be carefully balanced. And so anyway, I think I'm with you, and I think a hint of what you're saying is that it's really kind of unclear. I mean, that's an open area still, I think, and could use work, I think, but it's hard. I think the models are challenging. Yeah.
I guess that there has been some work, especially like using microsatellites and surveying lots of populations, if it's similar to what you saw, and finding a particular local population where a new or some microsatellites jump way up in frequency. Some of it has been interpreted as local selection variants, but perhaps it's also, with the in the new era, getting much better population surveys. But I'm going to make one more comment about this whole issue, and that is the question. My sense for this, especially like genome-wide association studies, is that they're already revealing sort of the cracks in the method. Many kinds of complex traits, and most phenotypes are have some complex genetic underpinning. And so if you want to understand the relationship between genotype, phenotype for real traits, biological traits, that it's not simply going to fall out of these kind of statistical analyses of genome sequences, that one is going to have to back up and study model organisms, go back to model organisms, and enter an era of basic research where we have a lot more tools to actually discover what those relationships are. And so...
But would you have to do that on a gene-by-gene basis?
Well, not necessarily, but I'm just advocating for using model organisms where you can carefully control the genetics, where you can do much deeper genetic analysis, and where you have the ability to make transformance and carry out specific experiments. So model organisms, experimental organisms, could be bacteria, yeast, all of the model organisms, and that all the effort is trying to understand complex traits, especially disease in humans, but perhaps a huge amount of resources should end up going, or will need to go to evolutionary biologists to...
Are you talking about epistatic interactions? Is it? Or?
Yeah, well...
Or is it broader than that? And if you give me a hint about how broader, I mean, what way...
I'm just saying that, say, $100 million into searching for autism genes or something like that, very little has come up. And in almost all the complex traits where people at this point are cherry-picking, still they explain maybe 4% or 2% or 6% of the overall trait variation. So there's just a great deal, most, if not almost everything, is left unexplained. So I don't know whether it's epistatic, but that's really what I'm talking about. That one has to learn these things, perhaps, when one can dissect it to a much finer degree, model organisms.
But could those studies you're suggesting help answer the question whether the difficulty is that there's 2,000 variants that contribute, each of them in an additive way to this thing from some kind of more complex interaction or something, and that the problem is just there's so many minor contributors? I mean, or is that more a matter of that the same people who are analyzing humans could come to that conclusion if they analyze this properly, or as the data sets get bigger and they track them down?
You know, it's just my own seat of the pants feeling that it's going to be hard to go too deeply into the actual models, genetic models, to explain the genome-wide association. I don't know. They're going to have 10,000 or 100,000 or a million humans, and one of the problems with humans is that the phenotype data and the genotype are very sensitively controlled. And you may get a genome sequence for someone, and they may have some interesting medical issue or problem, and that may go into the database, but you don't know anything else about that individual. And it's often just actually because of the anonymity, you actually can't go back and say, gee, it'd be nice if we could just study metabolomics and get all kind of additional data on you. I don't know. But don't you think that's...
Yeah.
I mean, that's an issue that requires a lot more kind of theoretical study. And somehow. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is sort of a related question. It's just given an organism and you what is the distribution of effects of mutations that you introduce? Or do you see, is it, I'm presumably it's sort of weighted towards zero, how much is it, are there tons and tons of things with little effects? And
the distribution of mutational effects. I agree with you to a large extent. There are these classic figures where on the x-axis you have sort of strength of selection, and on the ordinate, sort of the frequency of those mutations. And more or less, population geneticists just make them up out of the blue. The neutralists, the claim that here's neutrality and here's negative and positive selection, and they like to pile things up here, and then there's a big tail over here. I've always said, if we actually knew what this distribution was, we could all go home and claim victory. But this is, in many ways, the heart of the problem.
Absolutely.
What does this distribution look like? So, if there's a powerful way to do it with de novo mutations in a model system, one of the problems, though, and this is really a fundamental, one of the things that would be fun to discuss here is, as we talk about these things, the limits to knowing. Because kind of evolution is a highly stochastic process, and the physicists appreciate that deeply, but it's not so clear in evolutionary genetics that sort of we know what the limits to knowing are. Like with trying to take these messy data and make these difficult inferences. Well, there's stochasticity that just simply puts. I mean, you're dealing with probability space, and it's a complex one at all. And perhaps there's some theorems about the actual limits. No, what I was referring to here is that in an experimental setting, you say, okay, in E. coli, I can introduce mutations, and I can put them in a chemostat, and I can have a big chemostat size like that, and I can measure, what the effect it has on doubling time or viability, or something like that. I have colleagues who have been running chemostats their whole lives, and I'm not exactly making it, but maybe in E. coli chemostats, the limit of detecting selection is maybe on the order of 10^-4. I don't know, could you say 10^-5, but I think this is probably on the order of one part per 10,000. We can make it one part per 100,000. That is to say, if you have 10^-5 selective advantage, so you have to look at a lot of doublings before you pick something out. Okay, you can replicate, and of course one of the problems with the chemostats is that you introduce a mutation, but then you grow it up to 10^10, and those things are mutating. You can't control new mutations that occur, and eventually you get some event that actually dominates, and then your experiment is over. But so practically speaking, there's a limit something like that. Well, in E. coli, we talked about this selection being able to reach down to something on the order of the reciprocal of the population size. What's the population size of E. coli? I think there's maybe, I'm making up 10^12, 10^13 in each of us. Maybe the thought is there's something like 10^17 or 20th. I've seen these numbers in the world. Of course, humans are not the only ones who have E. coli in their guts. But then there's effective population size and not all of, and this is actually an interesting problem. E. coli has an immense population size. I don't care how you claim that things are going on, it's immense. And the polymorphism level, of course, is related to that. And once the population size gets much larger than the mutation rate, every site should be heterozygous. You look at E. coli, it's like 1% heterozygosity. You look at flies, it's 1%, 2% heterozygosity. Humans, it's much less than that. it's very, very rare to find. So you look at E. coli, I mean, if you were just trying to estimate, I mean, we know what the mutation rate is, so you can infer what the population size is. It's not that much different than fruit flies, things like that, which also have population size that are in the zillions. But there's something that restricts polymorphism to many, many orders of magnitude less. But my point is that in E. coli, the actual selection in that organism is many orders of magnitude lower. So we'd like to know what this distribution looks like, but we really, there are experimental, I think, limits to being able to estimate that, and we can't really get close experimentally to the real situation.
So 10 to the minus 5 was the accuracy with which you can do those measurements?
Yeah.
That's already quite good, I would say. And what do they find, roughly? Do you know?
Yeah,
this distribution.
You know, there have been some studies. There was something recently published, and I don't know the answer. But I can't remember. There was a paper. Maybe I can try to find it. That had some interesting twist on what some part of this distribution.
Yeah.
Exponential.
Do you remember? There was.
They were looking. They had a bunch of like microsatellite type markers, and so they would just look at how one of those would start to rise in frequency rapidly in an artificial experiment situation, and they'd see how often it happened and how fast they went, so they could estimate selection coefficients. Now, as Marty says, there's only a range in which you can get estimates for it, and I think there's a big effect on whether the environment, how different the environment is from what that E. coli has been growing in the past, and so I think there are lots of difficulties of sort of interpreting of it, but people were sort of pushing the rates and stuff. So, I mean, I think they were making progress, but there's still difficulties in interpretation, and I can't provide you a very good answer. I mean, anything quantitative.
I'm confused about the fundamental here. Is 10 to the minus 5 a big number or a small number?
I'm saying that in E. coli itself, perhaps selection, if it reaches down to something on the order of the reciprocal of the actual population size, maybe 10 to the minus 17 is
But then you have to assume that this polymorphism has the same selection coefficient over 10 to the 17 years, or generations. Isn't that pretty useless?
That's right. And as I'm saying, when you actually look at heterozygosities, it suggests maybe population sizes, you know, on the order of the 7th or 10th to the 8th or something like that. Maybe there's a few orders of magnitude separating the effectiveness.
So it's almost where you want to be.
So, you know, if you interpret the heterozygosity as indicating what the evolution.
But isn't this related again to time dependency, since E. coli is changing environment continuously? You know, it's going back and forth from different environments. You see, they didn't know this.
Well, this is a chemostat.
Yeah.
No, but the real.
Fluctuating on a time scale that's vastly faster than the 10 to the 5 generations that one can run it through. I'm not quite comfortable with that.
Yeah. But in any case, you know, when you think about E. coli, the actual census population size of E. coli in the world is some immense number, like 10 to the 15th or 10, you know. The per base mutation rate for doubling is on the order of 10 to the minus 8th or 10 to the minus 9th. That means, you know, in the species, every site is mutating a huge number of times. Every single base in the genome, every single 30 minutes, you know, you're getting millions of every base changing. So in terms of like the species trying out every possible mutation, they're being introduced in huge numbers. Now, of course, the probability that they actually stay in the population or get in, well, that's a, you know, issue of population genetics.
So once again, I'd like to comment on the viruses. The viruses have enormous population sizes too. Look at, take HIV.
Right.
We have billions of viruses in each individual. There's not two individuals anywhere in the world that have the same virus, every single person is infected with a different population of viruses, and the turnover is like 6 hours or something like that. And there you have mutations on every single site throughout the whole genome, and the mutation frequency is about 10 to the minus 5 mutations or substitutions per generation. So it seems like there are some organisms that, although they have mutations everywhere, you don't see them, and in others you actually do see them. And to come back to the phenotype here now, it's still HIV. There are mutations everywhere throughout the whole genome, but you can hardly see any phenotypic differences. That there are some, but not much. So there are definitely, the spectrum is pretty large here.
Is that linked to the fact that you're selecting for the viability of the virus in the hosts?
If you
find a sample of virus, then that sample has been selected for viability in its host. So you're restricted to seeing the variants that are compatible with that genotype.
I'm not sure I follow you, but you're saying that each individual host has a
well, you see, that wasn't what I was saying, but that could be part of it. But just the fact that you observe a sample of the virus, that you isolate a sample of the virus, means that sample has been able to grow and replicate,
right,
everything in its host.
But there, you know, the immunological environment is
changing
constantly. It's changing.
Yes.
And with those high mutation rates and ability to grow a lot of viruses, they respond very rapidly.
Right. Which brings us back to the selection again.
Yeah. Anyway, it's an interesting problem. If a lot of the, I mean, because at some level,
would be a bump, you know, also on the plus side of that distribution. Yeah.
But so some of this has to do with your belief about what sort of the grain is of environments and selection. I mean, my point is, like in E. coli, I don't know how much the environment for E. coli is really changing, but it's tried out every mutation, and one has to imagine it's a pretty well adapted organism. That it's a, you know. Now maybe there are different combinations of mutations that could, but
it's tried out every single.
But is the
double mutations?
Well, probably every doubles. I don't know. You know, at some point they have, right? And maybe that's key. But we really don't know that. But my point is that I don't know. Is the how likely is it that you can get a mutation in E. coli that actually pushes you, you know, way into positive selection territory? Negative, okay, that's fine. But in positive, or are those adaptive mutations that actually do? Are the real bread and butter and stuff of adaptive evolution just sitting in this little tiny zone here? Because the organism is so well adapted already, the only thing that could possibly, you know, best it is only going to best it by an extremely small amount.
Really interesting thing.
Where it becomes very important to know, you know, to push up against this limit.
But presumably the way you would do it is that you would move it into a somewhat pleasant environment and see how rapidly it would adapt to that, and you sort of start seeing adaptive changes in about 500 generations.
That's right, and you can do it with viruses too, like a number of people have been.
Yeah.
That's what I'm advocating, like much a resurgence of experimental evolution.
But then there's some indication that it just takes a few hundred generations or so.
But that's strong, that has to be very strong selection if you're going to see something in a few hundred generations. And those may be the outer limits of, you know, the capability of those experiments. But this is part of the reason why there was such huge optimism for statistical analysis of polymorphism data, because perhaps, you know, you can sum across a lot of data and detect
very weak signals, as I think Hiroshi apparently did with codon bias. Be hopeless, I shouldn't say hopeless, but perhaps almost like in Drosophila to actually substitute a single synonymous change and hope to be able to measure the effects on viability. But statistically, you could detect that.
So another sort of broad question is, given, I mean, presumably E. coli, one would think, is much more adapted to its environment than we are, our ancestors were. So how much of what we learn about the properties of adaptive mutation and things like that in E. coli are transferable to organisms like us or lions or, you know, insects even that have very different population sizes and very different evolutionary histories? I have no idea, but
I have an opinion, but someone else has an opinion. That's just what people think. That's a perfectly valid question. Now, I should say, just kind of accidentally, because I go running regularly, I have never. Friend is a prominent diabetes researcher, and he discovered recently in some cases of neonatal diabetes that they were able to map. These are they're dominant acting Mendelian mutations, and they were able to find some of them. Some of them map to the insulin gene itself, and so they've gotten a lot of cases now of de novo mutations in the insulin gene that cause neonatal diabetes. And most of them appear to be unfolding mutations. They hit disulfide bridges or something, and it looks like that what's possibly happening is that these proteins don't fold properly. They induce stress, in ER stress, and eventually turn on an apoptotic cycle that kills these beta cells. And that's actually what the cause of the diabetes is. But we talking about it, and we've tried to develop a fly model of diabetes. So one answer to your question is that certainly people in the medical field build models of human disease in model organisms. And those things have turned out to be very useful. And in general, when they're investigated, they act on the same pathways, and mutations that are recovered in suppressor screens, things like that, and these model organisms turn out to be useful, potentially as drug targets and things like that in humans. So at least in that sense, there's at least in the medical field, there's a broad acceptance of model organisms. The one thing we're trying to do is ask whether or not you could study genetic variation. Naturally occurring genetic variation. So generally what happens in the medical community, they create a model. So what we did is we expressed the insulin, these mutant insulin genes, on a promoter that expresses in the developing eye. And sure enough, the mutant, but not the wild type human insulin, when expressed in the fly developing eye, kills eye cells. So you do just look at simple phenotypic screen. So it looks like we're getting effect. But we already have some hints that mutant phenotype, the eye phenotype, is extremely sensitive to genetic background in the fly. And so we're very interested in asking whether or not we can study this difficult problem in humans, namely that there's an immense amount of variation for severity of disease or for disease susceptibility, even if you have a particular gene, and transfer that problem to the fly and just use the naturally occurring variation in the fly to study what that background variation is and how it kind of impinges on these disease models. But, you know, we're going to get exactly that question when it goes to grant panels.
Okay.
What does fly polymorphism have to do with, you know, human polymorphism? I think it just remains to be seen whether it turns out to be relevant. Well, maybe this is a good place to stop. This is a lot of fun. Let's take 10-minute break, something like that, and then we'll reconvene.